We've been fighting a long time, and we have all lost so very much, so many loved ones gone. But you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. You have no idea how important you are. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Ave Maria.
Welcome, everybody. Steve with Sense Pedellum coming at you with another book review with, if you haven't known his name, if you're on this channel and you're in our circle, you probably heard of Dr. K. I'm in the great state of North Carolina where Coach K is pretty much the king. So Dr. K, I go with the initials. And Dr. K, Coach K, welcome to the program. How you doing? Great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here. I'm doing fine. Thank you.
I know you just got back from a gigantic conference, but this book that he came out with is called Good Music, Sacred Music, and Silence. Funny thing, I started reading Cardinal Sarah's book exactly the same time I got yours. So I saw that going, oh, this is going to be really good. It did correlate well together. So why music? This is not just a regular music book. This is a deep dive into music.
Yes. So basically, I mean, the title of the book, I decided this time to give it a title that made it completely obvious what the book was about. So it's written in three parts. And the first part is simply on the art of music itself. Why is this art so important in human life? How does it move us? How does it form us? How does it enrich or impoverish our interior life? That's what the first part of the book is about. And there I make a really substantial argument with a lot of different examples of how music can be an elevating force in life, lifting us to a higher plane, culturally, intellectually, spiritually even, or how it can depress us. And I mean that both in the quite literal sense of make us feel depressed, make us feel sad and trapped within ourselves, but also depress us in the sense of push us down to the level of our passions and make us live more like animals. The second part of the book is the longest part. It's on sacred music in the church. And basically I say, look, if music is as important as we've just argued that it is in part one, then what are we doing with the music that we use for the sacred liturgy, the most important activity in human life, in the whole church, the central purpose of the church is to worship and glorify and adore God in this life to prepare ourselves for eternity, doing that with him, with the saints and angels in heaven who are always portrayed as singing and making music, right? So the music of the liturgy is not some kind of incidental, you know, take it or leave it, do whatever you want sort of affair. It's extremely serious. And that's what I get into in part two. And then finally, part three, which is appropriately the shortest, is the part on silence.
Yeah, because you didn't grow up coming out of the womb, start just listening to chant right off the bat. I mean, myself included, I was a Metallica fan. Went to all the concerts. You don't have mosh pits at symphonies.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me just say, that's funny that you bring that up. You know, very few of us begin our lives surrounded by Gregorian chant. However, I did give my own children that benefit because the first time I held my son and the first time I held my daughter in my arms, I chanted to them. I sang them a bunch of, you know, Salve Regina and Regina Caeli and Adorate Devote, whatever my tired brain could recall, I just sang chant to them. And actually, whenever I needed to walk them around at night to get them to fall asleep again, I would serenade them with chant. So that was something that was very special for me, and I hope for them too. Of course, they don't remember it, but I think maybe it had some deep effect. Let's hope. They both love chant today, so it didn't have a bad effect. You can put it that way. But yeah, no. In terms of my own childhood, you know, I grew up in a typical suburban New Jersey family. Everybody in my family was listening to rock music and pop music, and I was, you know, in high school I was listening to some rap and rock and never heavy metal. That never appealed to me, but anyway, I mean, I was kind of pickled in this musical environment, and I think the only exposure I would have had to classical music were the 5 or 6 second jingles that commercials used, you know, like the vacuum cleaner that's trying to, you know, that uses Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, you know, as a motto for, you know, in some kind of parodistic, ridiculous way. So I had no exposure to classical music, but my parents did love jazz, classic jazz, and they would put that on quite frequently at home. And although I'm not a huge jazz fan, I recognize it as a superior form of music to a lot of what you'd find on the radio. Certainly the superior musicianship and more sophistication to the music by a long shot. And so I did get exposed to that. And then really, I just, I don't know, I'm probably talking too long here, but I can tell you my sort of musical conversion.
No, you're good.
Yeah, you're good. So in high school, I had this, I went to an all-boys Benedictine high school. Very liberal place, still is, but very high educational standards, high academic standards, for which I'm grateful. And we had a Benedictine monk named Father Germain teach music appreciation to everybody. All the students had to take music appreciation. You know, and it was one of these courses that had a reputation for being an easy A, and you know, you just kind of had to sit through it. And but he played for us all the, what you could call maybe like, the top 40 hits of classical music, you know, Vivaldi's Four Seasons and Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik and, you know, Handel's Messiah, you know, bits and pieces from that, you know, the sort of things that are actually pretty easy to enjoy because they're just so beautifully written and they're so emotionally moving and they're pretty exciting, oftentimes like Vivaldi's Four Seasons. And so he would play those pieces for us and talk about them and help us to get into them. And I was actually kind of surprised at how much the students enjoyed listening to the music. They wanted more of it. I don't think it had a permanent effect on most of them, but for me, it was a total revelation. I couldn't believe, I was thinking, where did this music come from? It seemed like it had just had been, you know, had come down from heaven. It was so much richer and so much more glorious than anything I'd ever heard before. I mean, I'm not sure that I had the vocabulary at the time to express any of this. I just know that I was really affected by it and really taken with it. And so I would go to the teacher after class and I would say, I want to listen to more of this. Can you give me something? And he would give me some CDs from his collection. You know, this was the early days of CDs. We're talking about the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And he subscribed to something called the Musical Heritage Society. I don't even know if it exists anymore. But they produced these big series of CDs, Bach, Brahms, Beethoven, you know, just to stick with the Bs, Bruckner, you know, and they would produce these series, and he would just hand out a whole bunch of them to me and say, okay, just go and listen to these, and I'd take them home and listen to them and get into them and then come back for some more. So it was really a pretty dramatic, I would call it musical conversion that took place for me. This would have been, I think, a junior year in high school. And it was after that I discovered Gregorian chant, just listening to CDs. My first exposure to chant was on a CD recording. I had certainly never encountered it, you know, in a Catholic parish because this was the 1980s. You know? I mean, and today you still don't encounter it very often, but much more than back then. And so, you know, I heard this music and I thought, this is really eerie. This is kind of, you know, this is pretty wild stuff. What is this music? Because it is, when you listen to chant for the first time, it seems like it's coming from another planet. You know, it just simply doesn't sound like other types of music.
Right.
and so I asked this other teacher I had, because I had another music teacher who taught me composition, and who directed the choir in the boys' school. But I said, what is this music? And he said, oh, that's Gregorian chant. You know, that's what the church used to use for centuries and centuries. You know. So anyway.
Kind of what we thought, that joke at the beginning about not coming out of the womb. I've done the same thing with our kids, because I remember hearing something about they sleep better with some good chant or good classical music. So we got a couple CDs from the Nuns of Ephesus. Obviously, the fraternity CDs that come out, Sophia's come out with those. So we play them at night for them. So they've had it since the beginning. And I remember one of the first sermons I heard. One of the first spiritual masses I went to was. I remember this sermon like it was yesterday, 10 years ago. And he basically got up and was talking about, we should know the songs of the church. And I'm sitting there going, man, I wish this was recorded. This is brilliant. I never thought about this. And I don't know any of this.
And yes.
But yeah, we should know that. Like, you have that in your section. Some kids should know that. And
right.
Your kids, right. They know the salve. It's not that hard for them.
In fact, one of the things I point out in the book is that music is the language, if I can put it that way, that is most connatural to human beings. That is to say, it's quite natural for people to want to sing in a healthy culture. All healthy cultures are full of singing and music and dancing, for that matter. Good dancing, typically, not the mosh pits that you mentioned before. And music in particular really penetrates quickly into the memory and the imagination. And so it's easier, much, much easier to memorize music than it is to memorize prose or poetry, just recited, right? So, I mean, there have been studies to show this. If you try to memorize a poem, like the text of a hymn, and you just read it, it's going to take you about 20 times longer to remember those words than if you sang those words, right? Because the combination of the words and the music just sticks better in your mind. Our brains are wired for music, right? And this is part of the reason why almost every human being, probably 99% of human beings, love music, whether they have good taste or not, whether they've had any kind of education in music or not. They crave music. They want to have it accompanying what they're doing. And I mean, I think it's sad that the capacity of the human soul for music has been underestimated in our times. You know, in a former period of time, like in the ancient history of the church, hundreds of Gregorian chants were passed down by oral tradition, by monks and clergy and even laity, it seems from evidence, singing them. And this happens today too in Africa. You know, I know of situations, Africa, Indonesia, other places where there's still something more like an oral culture, where people have, common people, uneducated people, have whole Gregorian masses memorized because they've heard it and they've sung it and it's gone into their memories, just like the song, the alphabet song, goes into our memories. 26 pieces of unrelated information that we recall because we sing it to a song, right? And so little kids, they just absorb this stuff like a sponge, right? All of my kids and all the kids of the people in my communities that I've worked with over the years were all belting out Gregorian chant by the time they were 6 or 7 years old, right? They didn't even have to know what the words meant. That's not the point. It's a lifelong apprenticeship. We're all learning all the time. Yeah. And what I think, there's such a false emphasis nowadays by people in the church on rational comprehension, as if we have to understand every word at every moment. You know, that's ridiculous. There are things that I memorized through singing them that have taken me years to come to understand. And that's not because something was hidden from me by Latin. It's because the things we're dealing with are profound mysteries. And especially when you're dealing with the Word of God, I don't care if you're St. Augustine, you're still not going to get to the bottom of it, right? Yeah. So it's good for us to have certain things deep in our souls that we can keep meditating on them and keep bringing them back. Almost like, you know, the medievals used to compare Lectio Divina to a cow chewing its cud, right? Very homely metaphor. Yeah. You know, got to keep chewing on the Word of God. And eventually we're gonna get all the sweetness and all the nutrition out of it. And that's the way it is with the culture of the church, Catholic culture. It's something we should absorb over many years.
You bring it up slowly but sure. Kind of like what was it Francis said, I was talking about, like a hummingbee taking out nectar, or was it the savoring on the notes? Or because some people are like, maybe go like, oh, that alleluia or one of the lines may go forever, or seems like it goes forever, but I guess it's kind of like our wire, the bad music versus the good music. We're set for, you know, dump 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 dump, quick, give it to me now, versus long drawn out beauty.
Yes, I guess what you could say is something like this, that your soul is a battlefield, and the battlefield is occupied by rival troops. I think that's true for all of us. You know, there are many famous authors who say, and they say it in different ways, who say, you know, the human soul, the division between good and evil runs right through the human soul. You know, it's not me versus them. They're evil, I'm good, but the good and the evil are in me, right? This is the fallen human condition and disordered concupiscence. And all of our, whatever our habitual sins may be, you know, the fault line between what is godly and what is ungodly is right inside of our own souls. And in a way, the whole enterprise of the moral life, the ascetical life, the life of prayer, is to try to drive that evil out and to push that boundary between the armies, you know, further and further in the direction of the conquest of Christ the King, right? And so music plays a role in this too, because if we have, there's only so much space we have inside of us. And if we fill up that space with a lot of sonic garbage, you know, with a lot of highly propulsive, agitating music, with loud music, music that stirs up irascible appetites, angry feelings, that stirs up concupiscible appetites, lusts, right? Or the words as well as the music, it's both. If we fill our souls with that, there's less room in there for God. There's less room in there for Christ. There's less room in there for holy and wholesome thoughts, which is what St. Paul says we should be pondering. So that's what I say. You want to fill up this jug with the cleanest, clearest water.
Made me think of Father did kind of like a retreat once. He mentioned that nobody sings anymore. Kind of like the culture that used to sit, you see like the old movies. It's always singing going on in the movies, the good ones, obviously. But there's none of that in the movies today. But even in culture in general, you're surrounded by the dictatorship of noise.
Yes.
But nobody sings randomly, you know, like sporadic.
Yes. Yeah, no, this is a huge problem. And this is something that John Senior, the great educator, was really put his finger on. He said that every family should sing together. If possible, somebody can play the piano to accompany them, which is what everybody did before recorded music existed. Yeah. Is that every family had a piano and people could take turns playing hymns and songs and ballads, whatever that might be. You could, you know, people used banjos, they used guitars, they used violins. I mean, if you read about if you read the Little House on the Prairie series, you know, Pa is always playing his fiddle, right? I mean, this is the way people entertain themselves, is by making their own music. And that's not just a sort of nice sentimental idea. Oh, it was good for them back then, but they didn't have, you know, they didn't have the modern means of entertainment. Well, thank God they didn't have the modern means of entertainment, because they had to develop certain perfections of the soul and of the body to be able to create beautiful things spontaneously. And that's actually much more fun, much more enriching, much more familial and communal than just putting earbuds in and listening to some commercially produced stuff that a corporation wants to sell you to make a killing on it. You know, I mean, so anyway, I say in the book, recording technology has done great good for us as far as, like, if you want to get to know classical music, if you want to become familiar with some of the greatest music of all ages, it's very easy to do that if you have an intentionality, if you really take steps to do that. And in the book, as you've probably seen, I have some chapters that are very practical. They give suggestions about how to build your library of classical music, how to come to understand better the great music. Here are suggestions, specific pieces that you can listen to and start with and so forth. How to introduce classical music to your children. You know, I have all this kind of practical stuff in here. We need to know that. And recordings make that easy to do. But recordings have this huge downside too, that they discourage people from making music themselves. And I'll just say, so I don't go on forever on this topic. One of the most heartening experiences for me has been my involvement with college communities. Thomas Aquinas College, International Theological Institute in Austria, and then, of course, for 12 years, Wyoming Catholic College. Watching those students, often from homeschooling families, watching them singing together and making music together, it's happening. It still is happening. So I'll give you an example. Wyoming Catholic College had a dance a few months ago at which all of the music for the dance was live music. It was student musicians. They were playing guitars, fiddles, you know, whatever instruments they had, flutes, and they were playing folk music, classic folk songs. And there's a culture at Wyoming Catholic College, which comes from ultimately from John Senior, of singing folk songs. And lots of students memorize these folk songs, you know, like ballads with 10 verses, and they sing them with gusto together. I think that is so beautiful and so human and so wonderful. that we should be seeing that everywhere.
Yeah, I mentioned when you talk about the resources. I remember reading that chapter, and then my wife, probably about 5 minutes later, telling me about, wow, you know, no, we got to start homeschooling Steven soon, and I want to find something good for classical music. Page 99. Might not be 99. I just throwing a number out, but it was like, yes, he's got that listed. I'm going, wow, I didn't know all that existed.
Yeah, it's very good. It's very good.
When you mentioned about the folk stuff, I remember every time I went to an ordination afterwards, the party afterwards, one of the seminarians always had they brought out a fiddle, that someone had a guitar, someone had something, and they're singing outside. We're talking inside. You hear music outside going, what's going on? And it was like, light with moss. Everyone would flock to it.
Yes. Yeah, it's true. And this is also, by the way, this is also why, and it's a bit of a pet peeve of mine, but I spend time in a book really defending this position from every angle. I think it's very important for the Catholic laity to sing chant at Mass, at home as well. That's where they can learn it and pick up, especially the Marian antiphons for the season, Salve Regina, Regina Caeli, Almoradum Turris Mater, Ave Regina Caelorum, all those things. But you know, at Mass, at a high Mass, they should sing the Kyrie, alternating with the choir. They should sing the Gloria, again, alternating with the choir. That's the customary way of doing it. The Sanctus, the Agnus Dei, all the responses, Et Cum Spiritu Tuo, Deo Gratias, all those things. Why? Because these chants, for the most part, are not difficult to sing, not difficult to learn, especially if the Schola is intelligent about repeating a certain Mass setting for a whole season. That's what we do, for example, at our Schola, the fraternity parish that I go to, that, you know, for the Mass of Sundays of after Pentecost, it's nearly always Mass 11. For Sundays during Advent and Lent, it's Mass 17. For Sundays in Paschal time, it's Mass 1, and so forth. And what happens is you can hear the people singing downstairs. They get used to these chants and they sing them. And just because of everything we've already been talking about, that forms the soul. It forms the soul in a deeper way than if you just listen to them passively. There's nothing wrong with not singing if you can't sing. There are some people who really can't hold a tune, though if they work hard at it, sometimes they can learn to do that. Mm-hmm. But also if somebody's tired or they're just not in a mood to sing, okay, that's fine. I'm not saying we have to be like martinets, you know, everybody must sing. I'm not into that kind of activist participation. But the idea really of participatio actuosa, where everybody is singing those chants together, I think that that is just the una voce, that's the body of Christ in one voice singing to God. It's a beautiful thing, it's a fitting thing, and it's good for our souls to have that music in our souls, right?
I'm glad you brought that up, because Garanger brings that up, talking about the glory. I think it was, I can't remember which day he brings it up on, but he talks about the wall, make the wall shake with singing the Gloria, just the excitement, the enthusiasm, the joy that we should have at Mass anyway, but for the music itself. But that's a great point to do.
Yes, and in fact, there's a lot of historical evidence, and in fact, plenty of eyewitness testimonies of how Sunday Vespers used to be sung all over the place in Europe, and not just in Europe. But in, say, Italian churches, people would show up for Mass in the morning, and then later on they'd saunter their way back to church to sing Vespers. Yeah. And because Sunday Vespers, by the wise and prudent judgment of Holy Mother Church, it was always the same psalms, you know, Dixit Dominus, Domino Meo, you know, just always the same set of psalms, people had them memorized. No booklets, no translations, just everybody sang, you know, alternating side to side or alternating with the singers or however it was done in any given place. That's we need to get back to that kind of thing. And I think it's happening slowly, piano, piano, as the saying goes in Italian. It's happening in traditional, mostly traditional communities where people take sacred music and chant more seriously.
I was just thinking of be like the children, because I'm thinking my two kids that do sing, and they sing loud, especially at the end with the Marian hymns. They know, but it's up to us to teach them.
Yes, yes. Well, but my point is, if they're if they're in an environment, in a parish environment where everybody is seeing these things, they will absorb it by osmosis. Even if we don't have a set time in homeschooling when we're, you know, teaching these things. It's also good, you know, in terms of home, the liturgy of the home, so to speak, you know, put in that Marian antiphon after the rosary, you know, or, you know, sometime right before bed, you know, or sing the Angelus once in a while. I mean, or, you know, however, there are different things that one can do without being excessive. You know, it's always important not to try to turn the home into a monastery overnight, because that often backfires. It's just too much. But to think of little ways in which you can sprinkle in the chant of the church.
Yeah, my kids, my oldest loves, if everyone kind of factum est, he will repeat that all day long after I say. So he brought the Angelus. That's his favorite verse.
That's funny.
So during your piano chapter, I was waiting for Billy Joel to pop up. All I could hear was, play us a song, you piano man.
Yeah. So in this book, I mean, you know me, Steve. I'm not somebody who minces words. I'm not afraid to tackle controversial subjects. I may be wrong, and if I am wrong, I want people to refute me. But I'm not a coward. I'm not going to say lots of nice, pleasant things and gloss over the major problems of our time. So in the area of music, of sacred music, we have major, major problems in our times. We have hymns with heretical or sentimental or frankly stupid lyrics. That has to go. It has to go. We have music that sounds like second-rate Bob Dylan folk music. That has to go. It's unworthy of the temple of God. We have music that sounds like Broadway show tunes or, you know, lounge chord, lounge lizard bar music. That has to go. It's all of this is an insult to God, and it's also an insult to the intelligence of the faithful. And so, you know, piano music is forbidden in church. Pope Pius X wrote in his Motu Proprio Trale Solicitudine that pianos are not allowed in church. And that was never rescinded by the Holy See, by any subsequent musical legislation. There's been a lot of musical legislation. I quote it left and right in my book. I know it backwards and forwards. And some things in Pius X's Motu Proprio have been rescinded. For example, when he said women cannot sing the liturgical music in church, Pius XII walked that back. You know, he's, as long as the women are not in the sanctuary, they're in a choir loft, they can sing the Gregorian chant of the Mass. So certain things have been modified over time, but other things haven't been. And the prohibition, the absolute prohibition on the piano, is still on the books. Now, of course, we're living in a totally lawless period of time in the church, so nobody cares what the laws are. They just do whatever they want. Yeah. But I care what the law is, and I care because the law makes sense. Why is that the case? The piano is a secular instrument par excellence. It's a nice instrument. I love the piano. I have a piano. I play it. It's beautiful. But it originated in concert halls. It's a concert instrument. It's a percussive instrument. It's made to be loud, and the tone is supposed to penetrate and dominate your attention. It doesn't have the association with ecclesiastical and sacred music that the pipe organ has. The pipe organ is the normative, traditional, much lauded ecclesiastical instrument. There are hundreds of places in church documents where the pipe organ is praised. And when people hear the pipe organ, they think church music, right? I mean, that's how strong the association is. I think that, you know, when you hear the kind of piano music that's played in church, if it's classical music, you think, oh, it's a concert hall. And if it's schmaltzy garbage, you think, you know, oh, it's kind of like a bar, you know, like where there's somebody playing the, you know, tickling the ivories, right? It's a secular instrument, period. It doesn't belong in a church. And then guitars, folk guitars played in a folksy strumming sort of way, that's also secular, totally secular in its origins. And those are recent origins. You know, I'm not talking about ancient times. I'm talking about recently. When people hear the guitar played that way, they think, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary, or Bob Dylan, or Woodstock, or whatever. This is not like chant, polyphony, pipe organ. Okay. So, I mean, I go into more details about all of these things. I'm just giving kind of the skinny right now, but it's important for us to have these associations of what sounds secular and what sounds sacred are important. They're not just subjective. They're not just conventional. Why is that? Because when we get to Mass and we're in the liturgy, we should be in an environment that, in a sense, leaves the secular or profane world behind, mm-hmm. and catches us up into the worship of Almighty God and makes our hearts long for Him and long for heaven. That's not escapism. That's just setting aside time for God alone, consecrating it to Him, and purifying ourselves from time to time. It's almost like taking a spiritual bath. You know, we need to do what the Byzantines say. They say, "Now set aside all earthly cares." Mm-hmm. They say that in the famous Cherubicon, the famous hymn, that now set aside all earthly cares. Right, we're here to worship God. We're not here to recall our favorite, you know, popular music. Okay.
I remember one of my last non-355 Novus Ordo masses back in Sparmer, South Carolina. There was a flute in the top, and I told my mom I was about to go Animal House on that lady. And I could picture her doing it. I go, she plays that one more time, that's against the wall. But you see that in movies. I mean, Face Off had chants. There's all kinds of different movies that portray Catholic churches, and you hear Gregorian chant. I was in Santa Fe a couple years ago, and when you walk in, when they have it open for people just to come in to look at the old where Our Lady Conquistador is, there's chant being played by some CD or Pandora or whatever. But during Mass, it's the complete opposite. They turn the chant off, and it's something else. Yes. Like, wait, how do you exactly. do that for the people that don't go to Mass? But when Mass is going on, you just, man, we're doing whatever.
Yeah, no, I mean, I make this point in the book that there's a reason why over the centuries, distinctive forms of ecclesiastical art or sacred art have developed. So, for example, in the early church, the very beginnings, people were wearing their regular Roman clothing, let's say in the Church of Rome. But as time went on, because of the conservative instinct of Catholicism, which has always been there, and Newman talks about that in the essay on the development of Christian doctrine, which is this deeply conservative instinct, as secular fashions changed and people began to dress in different ways, the clergy kept wearing the ancient Roman clothing, including the chasuble, which was the outer garment of the Romans. And so as time went on, the ecclesiastical garb became more and more distinctively ecclesiastical, as in it was only ever used in church, while the clothing that people wore outside the church and their fashions continued to change, as it always changes, right? Same thing happened with language, right? That the liturgy was put into Latin, it seems, in the fourth century, although possibly it began even earlier than that. But once the liturgy was put into Latin and a very formal, solemn, high register of Latin, not the colloquial Latin of the streets, from that point onwards, there was very little change in the Latin of the liturgy. Obviously, later on, in later periods, other Latin texts were added, and those reflected the style of the Latin of the time. But the point I want to make is that when we hear the Latin of the Tridentine Mass right now, we're hearing first millennium Latin. We're hearing Latin of the early centuries, right? Just like the chasuble is the garment of the early centuries. And similarly, with the kind of vessels we use for Mass, you know, undoubtedly the early church vessels, the chalice for Mass, for example, would have been fairly simple. I'm not saying it was made out of, you know, ceramic or something. It was undoubtedly made out of something worthy, but it wasn't what it later became, which is, you know, a gold chalice studded with semi-precious stones, like you see in the medieval monasteries, right? Or the beautiful Baroque chalices with all of the filigree of gold and silver on them, right? But that, again, appropriately developed because we're trying to enhance what we give to God, and we're trying to give Him, you know, what is the most beautiful and the best that we can possibly give Him. And something that's, again, distinctive to the church, not something you're just going to find down the road somewhere else in a secular venue, right? And so music is the same way. Musical styles are always changing, always developing, for better or for worse. I think nowadays very much for worse, at least in the popular sphere. But church music, although it too has developed, has remained staunchly conservative. And that's why that's why the church says the most appropriate music for Mass is the music that grew up with the Mass and with the divine office, namely Gregorian chant. Chant wasn't, it's not like you had, people are so confused about this. It's not like you had the Mass being said for a while and then some brilliant person started writing Gregorian chants for it. No, the Mass was sung from the beginning, and the singing of the Mass is what developed into Gregorian chant. It's bone of the bone and flesh of the flesh of the liturgy is how it's chanted. Liturgy only existed in a chanted form. Gregorian chant is the liturgy in song, right? So it's not something added on to the liturgy. It simply is the liturgy in its authentic original form. And that's why we keep using that. And it's, I mean, quite frankly, the music is perfect for its purpose. It's perfectly suited for its purpose, and it's incredibly beautiful music, and it's unsurpassable in its kind.
I could always get Lady Gaga to record On Eagle's Wings for us. Maybe we'll make that better.
I think I'm going to have a nightmare now. Thanks to
that. No, there's a great part in the silence section about in the new rite, you have silence that seems like it's put in there outside of being authentic in the Mass itself. You mentioned the Father praying during, you know, the silent prayers or a chant just stopped or before the canon. And I remember thinking of like the new rite after you sit down, maybe Father sits down after the sermon for however long he wants to sit there. And it's kind of like, all right, when's the ticker going to go on? It's
yes.
When you were writing that, I was thinking that.
Yes, exactly. So when in the part of the book on silence, my attention is mostly focused on silence in the liturgy. Mm-hmm. Cardinal Seurat's book, which I cite, is of course a much more extensive treatment of silence across the board in all areas of life. But my interest is mostly in what's the role of silence in our corporate prayer, which we call the liturgy. And as you noted, the new liturgy. So the old, let me just start with the old liturgy, the classic traditional Roman rite. It is full of silences, especially at a low Mass, but these silences are not artificial. They're organic. They're simply the silence that happens when something is going on that you can't hear. So the priest is doing the offertory prayers, which are much more elaborate, much fuller in the traditional form. And so he's busy. He's doing things and he's saying all these prayers silently. And so you are plunged into a silence that just sort of develops because of the unfolding of the liturgy. And there's a subtle psychological benefit there, which is that it's not a dead space as like when the priest is just sitting there after the homily waiting for however long he makes everybody wait for. That's dead space. Nothing is happening. We're all just supposed to be doing something, and it's very easy to get impatient and wonder especially if the sermon wasn't that great. You know, I mean, I don't know about you, but there's rarely been a sermon where I really felt the need to like ponder this, you know, these sententious, you know, the wisdom of, no, I just want to kind of, let's get on with the thing, you know. But with the Trinity Mass, you can get on with the thing and yet still have lots of natural silence and periods that you can fill with your own prayer that you unite to the prayer of the church. And the prayer of the priest. So I think that's a marvelous feature of what you could call a saturated silence and a meaningful silence, as opposed to a kind of scripted and artificial one.
When you talk to, I don't want to call anybody a normie, but if you talk to somebody who goes to a new Mass and has no clue about anything else of the trad Mass, because I was there once, I had zero clue on this. What do they say when you bring up, well, Vatican II said in Sacrosanctum Concilium that Gregorian chant is supposed to be in it? Do they give you like a glass overview? I mean, what's the response you get?
Right. Well, yes. I mean, of course, I do talk a lot about Sacrosanctum Concilium, paragraph 116. Is it 116 or 114? Anyway, it's right in that section on
Sacrosanctum. We'll flog you later for missing that.
It's all right. I'm not a rigid person, so it could be 114, it could be 116. But anyway, it's right in that section where Sacrosanctum Concilium says that it says, ceteris paribus, all things being equal, Gregorian chant should have chief place, principem locum in Latin, in church services, because it is the music proper to the Roman Rite. Now, that's a pretty remarkable statement. There's quite a lot packed in there. What it's saying, I think you can plausibly defend that the meaning of it as intended by the author of that chapter of Sacrum Sanctum Concilium, which was a man named Monsignor Johannes Overath, what he intended to say was, even if, for the sake of argument, you said all types of music, sacred music, were equal, nevertheless, because chant is the music that grew up with the Roman Rite, that clothes its texts in music, that is native, so to speak, to the Roman Rite, because it's proper to it, therefore, it ought to have chief place, principium locum, right? That's what's being said. Not that you can't have other styles of music, but that you shouldn't let any other music in the Mass elbow out the music that is native and proper and most appropriate to the Mass or to any liturgical function that has chant. That was said there. The Council Fathers, if you look in the debates, they all understood what was being said. They all agreed to it. Very few of the over 2,000 Council Fathers who signed Sacrum Sanctum Concilium wanted chant to disappear. It was used throughout the Second Vatican Council at all of the Tridentine Masses that were celebrated there, right? The Mass of the Council, in a certain sense, is just the Tridentine Mass because that's what they were celebrating for 4 years together. So they all expected that the chant would continue. And in fact, that's the strongest and clearest statement made in the Magisterium of the Church about the centrality and primacy of Gregorian chant, remarkably enough. So it's just absolutely bizarre that that provision of Sacrum Sanctum Concilium, along with many other provisions, has been simply ignored. And when you tell people about this, I think by now anybody who has even the slightest interest in liturgy has kind of heard these things or knows that they're there. And typically the response is either, yes, they were right, and this is what we should be doing, and what's our problem? Let's get busy. Let's rebuild our sacred music, which is what I advocate, of course. Or they say something like, well, you know, in the early 60s, the Council Fathers didn't really understand what a radical change was necessary, you know, in modern times to reach modern people. And it was really only Paul VI later on and the Concilium that understood all the implications of Sacrum Sanctum Concilium. And so basically the spirit of the Council has dictated that we surpass the letter of the Council, right? We can say that was a historic moment, but really, really we've moved on since then. And we have to do something much more pluralistic and enculturated now, or whatever, right? That's what the progressives and the liberals will say. And they're wrong, and we can demonstrate that they're wrong.
I was just thinking of Back to Beauty. It was when St. Thomas Aquinas Parish in Charlotte, North Carolina started a traditional Mass. There was a lot of regular people. The 11:30 crowd, it wasn't a traveling. It was the 11:30s that went there were the same ones that stayed around. And there was a lady sitting in the back. I'll never forget her. She was she told my wife, I don't know what's going on, but this is beautiful. And she was just loving that she could sit there all day for the chant.
Yes. Yes. I think so. That experience, which of course is one that many, many people have had. And I noted in a talk I gave on why do the FBI and Pope Francis care so much about the Latin Mass, something like that is the title on my YouTube channel. In that talk, I quoted a whole bunch of testimonials from people who have rediscovered their faith, really, and renewed their relationship with Christ through the traditional Mass. And I point out, I said, I used to collect these testimonials years ago because I thought, oh, these will come in handy if I collect all. And it just got to be too many, like hundreds of pages of testimonials. You know, it is effective. It really does. It works. And should we be surprised that the traditional liturgy works when century after century after century Catholics used it? The church was flourishing. Churches were full. There were saints, canonized saints. I mean, if the liturgy wasn't working, then you can't explain any of the phenomena of Roman Catholicism for most of its history, right? So I hold in the deepest suspicion any claim that begins something like the following. Modern man could no longer relate to or understand or appreciate the traditional liturgy. Therefore, .. That's baloney. What you have to do is stop somebody, hit the pause button, and say, before you finish your statement, I dispute your premise. Your premise is false. I love the traditional mass. My children love it. My friends love it. You know, everybody I know who goes to it is totally into it. We're not classical scholars. We're not some kind of elite. We are, I mean, some of us know more than others, granted. But everybody can appreciate this. Everybody from the simplest person, the worker in his overalls, all the way up to the college professor, they can all appreciate this because it works on many levels. It works on all the levels of the human being. It's a holistic act of worship. It appeals to all of our senses. It appeals to our intellect, to our heart, the motions, the symbols, the ceremony. It's beautiful to watch. You get lost in it. You start wondering what it means. You ask people what it means, or you start reading about it. It takes you deeper into the faith. I mean, it's such an organic, natural process. It's like, basically, going to the traditional liturgy is like being a tomato plant in a greenhouse. You know, it's like ideal circumstances for you to grow slowly, right? And to be luscious and sweet at the end of it, right? This is what we want. I think that most people who speak against the traditional liturgies of the church, all of them, really, any of them, they don't have enough experience. They don't have the humility and the patience, and maybe they don't even realize that they lack those things, but it seems to me objectively, they don't have the humility and the patience to sit at the feet of Holy Mother Church and her tradition and soak it in and be formed and shaped by it and be nourished by it. But if you let yourself go and you really surrender yourself to it, then it does marvels and wonders.
I can vouch for the knowledge part because I'm reading it and he's listing all these classical musics and I'm going, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. And I'm thinking, my music appreciation class, I remember it was the opening of Star Wars. I got that one.
Well, you know, it's funny. Star Wars, the composer of the score of Star Wars is John Williams, probably the most famous movie score composer. And, you know, in classical music circles, he's kind of criticized a bit for the Star Wars score because he ripped off so many ideas from Gustav Holst's The Planets. Especially, I mean, Gustav Holst's The Planets is one of the all-time greatest classical pieces. I listed in the book as one of the things you got to listen to. And there's a movement. It's a fascinating symphonic poem. It has one movement for each of the planets. In the solar system, and each one is sort of reflecting the character of the planet in the mythology that led to the name of the planet. You know, Venus, Mars, Mercury, so forth. And he doesn't do Earth. He just does the other planets. And so Mars, right? Mars, the god of war, is this incredibly intense, martial, orchestral piece of music. And if you listen to that and then you listen to the Star Wars score, the main, you know, theme is, it's like he just ripped it off from Holst, you know.
Wow.
So movie composers, in fact, for the most part, that's one of the few areas in pop culture where there are still serious composers working. They can get good work. If somebody wants to do like an epic adventure film, they usually want an orchestral score because it's very moving. It kind of sweeps you off your feet, goes with the majestic scenery, whatever it might be. So there's still orchestral music being written for films. And if you look back in the history of Hollywood, the first film composers were classically trained musicians from Europe, some of whom were fleeing Nazi persecution. So for example, Eric Korngold? Eric Wolfgang Korngold? Anyways, his last name is Korngold, K-O-R-N-G-O-L-D. He fled from Germany, came to America, and he started writing movie scores for lots of classic films. Like, I think he wrote the one for the Errol Flynn Robin Hood, you know? Okay. And when you listen to when you listen to these movies and you try to pay attention to the score, the film score, then you realize, wow, this is a really well-written film score. You know, this is almost like a classical concert, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously adapted to the needs of the screen. So classical music has kind of curiously survived in a way through that genre.
That's the Last Mohicans. I remember that one. Mm-hmm. it was filmed in our area. So there's this. Anyways, Dr. K, appreciate your time on this. Go ahead and pitch yourself. You got a website, don't you?
I do. PeterKwasniewski.com. You've already got it up there. But I do have another website you should share with people, if you don't mind. It's CantaboDomino.com. CantaboDomino.com is my website as a composer. So I have about 150 pieces of music there that I've written, mostly sacred choral music. And you can listen to them, you can download them, you can, you know, read articles about music, and so forth. It's a pretty comprehensive site for all things musical. If you click on sheet music, sheet music. Yeah, you'll see these are just some of my compositions here for the church, both in English and in Latin.
Nice.
So it's neat. It's a pretty new website. That's why I'm mentioning it. Also, I do have a Substack that I recommend to people called Tradition and Sanity. So you can find that. There it is. Got it. So please check it out sometime. That's where I'm putting a lot of my best writing these days. And I talked, for example, about Sister Wilhelmina, my visit to adding a new friend to my favorite intercessors. So visited her apparently incorrupt body. It certainly looks incorrupt, as far as I can tell, everybody who's examined her has said this is an absolutely inexplicable phenomenon. She should not be there anymore. And then finally, as far as getting this book itself, it's from TAN, right in your neighborhood, right, Steve?
Yeah, about 5-8 miles, 8 minutes away from me.
Exactly. So there it is. It's at TAN Books. You can get it straight from the publisher. Of course, you can get it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, other places. So.
Very good. Now, Doctor, again, appreciate your time. And everything will be underneath in the show notes, as always, underneath the video. So, yeah, thanks very much. And, hit me up next time you got a good book coming out, and we'll do it again.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Which isn't too far away. I joke with people saying you're the Glenn Beck of Catholicism with books. It always comes out.
Well, I am grateful. I'm grateful to Almighty God that he's given me the opportunity to devote myself to writing and speaking on all of these wonderful themes of our faith. It's something I get up every day. I love what I do. I look forward to it. I look forward to sharing all these things with people.
Oh, very good. Well, glad you can write, because I can't.
All right. God bless.